no gossip.
Turn it off. I could stop babbling. That'd be all right.
I want to thank you for attending the first meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. Just a quick announcement. The Senate Republicans are still caucusing, and I see that there are some Republicans who are here anyway, so you get extra points for your attendance. And the DFL Senate caucus, time has been changed. It's not 2 o'clock anymore. It's now 2:30. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So we will have a little bit extra time in this committee. With your indulgence, I'd like to read a brief statement. Thank you for your attendance and welcome to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee of the Minnesota Senate. A special welcome to the new members of the Senate, Senators Skogan, who is serving as Vice Chair, Senators Sieben, Ingebrigtsen, and Sharon. We're excited to have you on this committee. And I'm excited to serve as committee chair, but am equally apprehensive as this is my first committee chairmanship. As such, I welcome and encourage discussion and advice from the committee, particularly our senior senators. That is, I mean to say, our more experienced members. As in the past, I bring to the Environment Committee a passion for Minnesota's outdoors. From camping at the Mississippi headwaters to hunting pheasants in Tracy. From the cabin on a lakeshore to strolling the Como Zoo. From canoeing the Boundary Waters and biking the Munger Trail to wading the Root River for trout. From the ice house on Lake Mille Lacs to the duck marshes of Windham, Minnesota's outdoor heritage is matched by no other, and I, for one, want to keep it that way. Every Minnesotan deserves the freedom to seek the spiritual, creative, and intellectual renewal that nature can provide. And in that endeavor, we must learn that there is no difference between the environmentalist and the hunter, that preserving the environment can create more jobs than destroying it, that naturalists can see the benefits of dedicated ATV trails, just as the ATV rider must become concerned with rare plant species. I hope to work with every committee member on common sense policies towards the outdoors and the environment, and I hope we promote tolerant attitudes amongst various stakeholders. Environmentalists must stop seeing hunters as gun-toters, and hunters must stop seeing environmentalists as tree huggers. Heck, I know a few of each that rarely take a bath. Sportsmen or naturalists, there can no longer be a contradiction in both. All benefit from clean water and more habitat. All have a voice. My personal feeling is that every bear hunter should be hugging a white pine, and every naturalist should be buying a pheasant stamp. So to that end, our committee will consider legislation including but not limited to global warming, dedicated funding to the environment, clean water legacy, game and fish issues, wetlands, ecotourism, and electronic waste disposal, to name just a few. Legislation has been introduced for our committee to consider regarding dedication of a portion of our sales tax to wildlife, clean water, and our parks and trails. I feel the time is right to take this important step to ensure Minnesota's resources are there for future generations to enjoy. We need to act now to ensure Minnesotans are never denied what we and our forefathers have enjoyed as part of this great state's natural wonders. By introducing this bill early in the 2000 session, we send a clear message that we are serious about natural resource funding and that after 10 years of this legislation, we intend to get it done. With that, we begin our committee schedule with what I believe is an important overview of Minnesota's environmental history. The four-part series, A History of the Land, provides an accurate and non-judgmental recapture of Minnesota's environment and how it has changed over the last few hundred years and what factors have impacted those changes. Afterwards, we will hear from one of the sponsors of the film and be able to ask him questions. Again, I want to thank members for their attention and involvement, and at this time welcome any additional comments from the members. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your comments very much. And I just wanted to point out, in case you weren't going to say this at the beginning, that this film was funded by an LCMR grant by the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, and I thought members would want to know that. And I'm sure you'll be hearing, for those who are new or maybe aren't familiar with the commission, it is a now a commission of legislators and citizens together that are able to make recommendations for the Environmental Trust Fund dollars that come from lottery tickets to go to environmental and natural resource projects. And a number of us have served on it, and this is one of the neat things that the LCMR has done in the past, is helped to fund this really important project. So thanks for bringing it.
Thank you.
To the committee.
Senator Scogin, as our vice chair, would you like to introduce yourself in your district?
Senator Dan Scogin, District 10, Otter Tail, Wadena County, and 6 townships up in Becker County. Otter Tail County with over 1,200 lakes. So I'm excited to be sitting on Wadena County with like 1 lake. The glacier didn't figure it out when it was coming by. But I'm glad to be sitting on this committee. I have legislation with me today. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask for some help just with some names. Signing off on your clone to the dedicated fund legislation. So before we leave today, if somebody's got some names, especially from the House, that I should be talking to about this legislation, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Vickerman.
I'm Senator Vickerman. I'm probably one of the old-timers around this place. I've been here 20 years, and I represent the district right where our chairman was hunting in both places. I represent ag, and I'm very strong in it. So I shook hands with my good friend here, said we need to work together. Mm-hmm. I meant that.
Absolutely.
Because we need both environment. We got to keep farmers farming too.
Of course. Of course.
Tracy's my home address.
Hi, I'm Senator Ellen Anderson. I represent St. Paul and the city of Falcon Heights, which includes the State Fairgrounds and the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus. And represent beautiful, the one lake in my district is Como Lake, and I know probably every one of you have been to Como Park, and you'll find that one of the fun things in this committee also is that we have jurisdiction over the state parks and all the regional parks, and Como Park, which you'll be hearing about a lot from me, has over several million visitors a year. It's one of the most visited attractions in the state, and so we welcome you to all come. In fact, we set up a tour anytime, so come over and see the new buildings there. It's just beautiful, and it was built with the help of the legislature.
Okay, I think we have our first suggestion for a committee field trip.
Let's go.
Senator Dill.
Steve Dill, a state senator from Dassel, Litchfield, Hutchinson area. I'm the lead Republican on Senator Vickerman's Ag and Veterans Affairs Committee, and it's my 20th year in the legislature. As I look back on the environmental issues that I've been heavily involved in, I was a co-author of the 1991 Wetland Conservation Act and heavily involved in much of the wetland legislation since then, plus all the feedlot legislation that I think has come past us. I've been involved with that. And then I was also involved with the NSP dry calf storage bill down there at Red Wing, something that Senator Anderson and I couldn't agree on, but I think history proved I was right. And then the fourth thing was the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe's out-of-court settlement bill, the 1837 treaty bill, which I was on the side of doing the out-of-court settlement, and that bill failed by 2 votes in the House. It passed in the Senate. And the Supreme Court basically ruled that Arne Carlson and those of us that authored that bill were right, too, that we should have settled it out of court and been done with it. But I look forward, I appreciate your statement. Your opening statement, Mr. Chairman, was very good, and I appreciate that. So I look forward to working with you on all these issues.
Thank you. Senator Sieben.
Hi, I'm Katie Sieben. I'm newly elected senator from District 57. I previously served in the House for 2 terms, and my district now includes 2 river crossings, the Wakota Bridge, which crosses the Mississippi, and then further south, the Hastings Bridge, which also crosses the Mississippi and intersects closely with the St. Croix River. Afton State Park is also in the district, and It's a great place, so happy to be here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm Kathy Sharon, Senator from Senate District 23. Excuse me, I got a little something caught in my throat, so I may not go for very long, which is probably just as well. Anyway, Mankato, which is my home community, is at the confluence of the Blue Earth and the Minnesota River. We have a lot of agricultural communities in my area. It's a strong economic force in our area. We also have a great deal of interest in improving watershed and resolving septic system issues in our area. I'm also very interested in the dedicated revenue for that you're talking about.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Newly elected Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen, District 11, includes the counties of Todd, Douglas, Grant, and Stevens, 82 townships. Very diverse, very agricultural on the west end. Grant and Stevens County, full of agriculture, as well as large feedlots. As well as, of course, many, many lakes, waters, and streams that go through our county, Douglas and then Todd. So I'm very, very interested in working on the committee. Looking forward to it.
Hi, I'm Tom Saxog. I represent District 3. That starts at the northwest angle and Lake of the Woods and works its way down through Rainy, International Falls. I'm from Grand Rapids. It ends at Mille Lacs Lake. It's roughly the size of Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in northern Minnesota, but particularly in my district, we have an excess of 96% of our pre-settlement wetlands. And if we don't start controlling the beavers pretty soon, we're going to have an excess of 100% of our, pre-settlement. But so unlike all, we're certainly interested in water quality. It's just that we have a lot of water and the absence of it is not our problem. Minnesota, and I include all of us in it, has the largest unpolluted aquifer in the United States. It wasn't always, and I should say the Connell 48, it wasn't always the largest. It used to be the Everglades in Florida, and we know what happened to the Everglades in Florida. So it's important for us to keep considering our waters and keep them healthy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm Scott Dibble, State Senator from District 60, which is southwest and downtown Minneapolis, starting my second term in the Senate after having served one term in the House. It's my first stint on the Environment Policy Committee, though I did serve on the Environment Agriculture, Environment, and Economic Development Finance Committee last session. But I've had a number of bills that I've brought through this policy committee in my time, both the House, the corresponding House Committee, as well as in the Senate last term. Some of my focus has been on air and water quality, dealing with the toxins. I was the chief author of the mercury bill last year, though it didn't come to the Environment Committee. It certainly had significant environmental implications. I've carried a number of bills that deal with the preservation of our natural areas and resources, particularly in the bonding bill. Have focused on some of those that boost our recreational opportunities, as well as deal with our recreation policies. I appreciate very much being seated between Senator Stumpf and Senator Saxog and look forward to those conversations. those will be really fun. And I like that Senator Anderson is in between Senator Dale and Senator Vickerman. Well, we're going to have a good time. And your statement actually was a good one at the beginning. And I think I really think it touches a chord that we're all looking for. And that is that there is something that unites Minnesotans. And that is their appreciation of our environment, their appreciation of our natural areas, their appreciation of all that brings to us personally and to us as a state and as a state as a whole, from an economic perspective, as well as what gives us an advantage over a lot of areas. And we really do have the opportunity to find some common ground and some common threads and move forward with some policies and some financial priorities that benefit all of us. So I look forward to an interesting 4 years. The big looming issue that we can all rally around is global warming, and what does that mean for our forest industries? What does that mean for our recreation? What does that mean for our wildlife? All of that. So It'll be a good committee.
Well, Mr. Bogus can maybe confirm this, but it's my understanding that the state record muskie was caught in your district.
I don't doubt it. Even though I'm a city representative, I am an outdoors enthusiast. I do quite a bit myself in other parts of the state. But my own district has the chain of lakes. It has Theodore Worth adjacent to it. Many, many people come to my district, in addition to Senator Saxhog's district and Senator Bach's district, to experience the outdoors and to recreate. And millions and millions and millions more people than go to Disney World come to my district to recreate outdoors.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. And we will... We can have introductions for senators, other senators, as they roll in. I'd like to introduce the staff as well. Mary Ann Hecht is my committee administrator. Greg Knopf is Senate counsel. Carol Baker is...
I'm Senate counsel.
Oh, you're Senate counsel.
Same office.
We're at the same office.
Senate Research and Senate Counsel.
And then Mary Bibas is my legislative assistant. Donovan Hurd is the committee clerk. Laura Silver is our intern for this session. Dan Mueller is sitting there. And could you both introduce yourselves as well?
Oh, I'm Gloria Dundas, Senate Majority Research.
Patrick Coburn, Senate Minority Research.
Are we good on the introductions then? So are there any other comments from the committee? If not, we can start the presentation.
State was grassland, 20,000 square miles of Minnesota was grassland, and today most of it's gone. It's hard to know a landscape when that's all that remains of it.
Landscapes really do have a history. They change all the time. And we are certainly, as humans, intervening into that process of change with an outcome that we can't actually know.
Forces of ours upon the world are getting rid of the very resources upon which we built this society we have.
In the transformation of the Minnesota landscape, much has been gained and much has been lost. This series uses the lessons of the past in weighing our choices for the future. The stories that follow. Itself.
where the waters reflect the heavens. So this area, this land, we have a relationship that is really thousands and thousands of years old with it.
I'd like to say that this area never was a wilderness. The whole idea of wilderness is misnomer. Just the minute that that ice melted and the ice field for to the north of there, there were people there. Banking societies made up of all kinds of specialties. And they had a mythology that would fill several Bibles, and that they were very old and very ancient, even. Their knowledge of herbs and the landscape around them could fill up botanical textbooks, carry all this material right in their heads. Acutely aware of how natural systems work, they knew how to manipulate elements of their constantly changing environment, not only to survive, but to prosper. One such element was fire.
Native Americans frequently used fire for many, many purposes. They saw that it was a part of nature, that it in fact recycled nutrients, promoted lots of plant growth, which then attracted lots of game animals.
But fire wasn't the only way in which Native Americans shaped the land around them. By the 1700s, both the Dakota and Ojibwe who made their homes here were shaping the land in significant ways.
We had our hand on that land. That's always a really important concept to remember. A lot of people think that this land was a vast, untouched wilderness, which indigenous people just kind of wandered things. Instead of recognizing that actually, whether it was burning the underbrush to keep your forest good, keep good grass that would grow and get rid of some of the wood ticks, or whether it was managing your wetlands, your beaver populations, managing your water levels for your wild rice crop. I think that by and large within our native traditions there is this immense ethic, this middle Miocene in this way that you live, which is something to do with the continuity of living in one place, of observing intergenerationally the changes on land, and the behavior of all of your relatives that are four-legged and two-legged and, trees and winged. Of your behavior as a part of the world, and the ramifications of your behavior in that bigger picture, and that if you're going there for 10,000
years, you'll be there for that house. The world those early people knew so well was in fact a place of some remarkable convergences. Here, in the heart of the North American was a place where the level treeless plains of the west met the rolling wooded hills of the east. Here too,
it was like an eagle.
Weather systems collide. Where dry westerlies stripped of their moisture by the Rockies meet wet warm air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico and the cold weather systems coming out of Canada. Collision that makes for a place drier and warmer to the southwest, wetter and cooler to the northeast. Climatic condition is critical to what can grow here.
Minnesota is at the meeting place, if you will, of these three major
River, the Mississippi, rises here and flows south to the Gulf of Mexico. A meeting place of water, weather, topography, and biomes that would one day be captured by the boundaries of Minnesota.
I think one of the really remarkable things about Minnesota is precisely that it sits on so many key boundaries that define the mid-continent of North America.
An ecological crossroads that by the 1600s became a cultural crossroads as well. As humans vied for the resources of the area, a process that profoundly changed the ecological landscape itself, one that continues to this day. In the mid-1600s, an event took place in Europe that could have far-reaching consequences for this land west of Lake Superior.
When King Charles I of England donned a beaver hat in court,
he started a fashion craze that lasted for over a century
and sent European
fur traders deep into the heart of North America. To the French, who were the first to arrive here in the late 1600s, and the British who replaced them, the land was a place of impossible abundance. A well-watered world, rich in fur-bearing animals and game.
Beaver, of course, is what everyone hears about, and it certainly was very important. This was a great cash market, but other things were hunted also. All fine furs, what we Berman, which is a winter coat of a weasel, Martin, Fine Martin, Fisher, Fox, Wolf, Raccoon, all of those things were hunted and traded.
Thousands of years, native peoples had used the network of rivers and lakes left by the glaciers to transport trade goods by boat. Now that system was used to export furs to markets in Europe and to bring in manufactured European goods. Critical to the trade west of Lake Superior were the Dakota and Ojibwe, who did all the hunting and trapping and supply the European traders with food. But where the Europeans saw these animals as simply resources, the Indians continued to see them as important parts of their personal landscape.
The attitude to the beaver was one of the beaver has to be treated with tremendous respect because the beaver brings all these things. Was the beaver there? Even though in reality they have trader bring it. Not his name. His tribes. Cattle.
The Indian-based fur trade lasted for over 250 years, and its effect on the animal populations across the region was relatively minor. But beginning in the 1830s, variation of the trade arose that would have drastic consequences. What happened to the bison in Minnesota was a harbinger of things to come.
St. Paul became an important transshipment point for buffalo robes. St. Paul was at the head of the navigation on the Mississippi, and goods could be brought in by river or ox cart down from Pembina and placed on steamboats and taken down to the railroad terminus in Galena and shipped to the east.
Bison had long been an important part of the landscape of Minnesota. They were essential to the Dakota, who not only hunted them for food, hides, and other influence, but also for the fur trade. Bison could be found throughout Minnesota. They were particularly numerous. floor of the Red River Valley. In 1801, Alexander Henry, a British trader with the Hudson Bay Company, recorded a typical encounter. At daybreak, I was awakened by the bellowing of buffaloes. I dressed and climbed my oak for a better view. I had seen an almost incredible number of buffalo in the fall, but nothing in comparison to what I now beheld. The ground was covered at every point of the compass, as far as the eye could reach, and every animal was in motion. Somewhere between 30 and 50 million, an untold multitude in Minnesota alone. In a remarkably brief time, they would be hunted to near extinction in the state, primarily by a people known as the Métis. They were mainly a mixture of Cree, Ojibwe, French, although there were some more Scottish and other groups. Based in Canada, at the northern end of the Red River Valley, the Métis were among the first to discover the benefits and pitfalls of specializing in the growing catch. They made their living outside of the traditional role of European peoples in the fur trade as traders. They spent a good part of the year hunting buffalo, and they were also the people who brought the buffalo robes down to St. Paul. Responding to a fierce demand for hides and tongues from the East, the Métis in the 1830s developed a mass hunting strategy that was unparalleled in its efficiency. On July the 4th, 1840, a writer named Alexander Ross described one such hunt. The picture he presented was astonishing. 1,210 ox carts, 620 hunters with over 1,000 wives and children, 740 guns and over 1,000 horses. When they finally returned 6 weeks later, they carried with them over 1,000,000 pounds of hides and meat. Others hunted the Minnesota herds as well, but none were as efficient as the Métis. Their participation in an unfettered market that had no regard for the ecological landscape rapidly had its effect. In fewer than 50 years, the bison were all but eliminated from the state. Other elements of the old landscape would now follow. Political control did not mean ownership, and this was a problem with the new government in Washington. For although the Indians held no deed to it, the land belonged to the tribes and bands who lived on it for as long as memory.
Traditionally, our Indian people in my community and in other Indian communities, by and large, we hold our land collectively, and then we have individual family or extended family use rights, and those are allocated in a whole variety of ways. But that is a totally different concept of land ownership than private property, a use right. In that, we take that, even that term Anishinaabe Akim, they say that that doesn't necessarily mean that land that belongs to you, it means the land to which you belong.
For the Americans, however, that same land represented only potential, significant only for how it could be used to produce income, something that could be transferred from one people to another with a signature on a piece of paper.
Let's take the state of Minnesota. If we had a map of it and we made it like a jigsaw puzzle, or we made it like a patchwork quilt,
by piece, from 1837 to the dawn of the 20th century, the Dakota and Ojibwe were forced to cede their land to the U.S. government.
Those treaties were very unfair. It was unrealistic to start with the whole idea at that point of a treaty. And the idea that it was a bargaining session was also false, because there can't be any bargaining where all the power is on one side. And everybody knew where the power was. The actual money paid for the land, how could you pay for a way of life?
We are dying and fading away. We are dropped to the ground like the trees from the axe of a white man. I grieve but cannot turn our fate away. The sun, the moon, the rivers, the forest we love so well, we must leave. We will soon sleep in the ground. Ojibwe Elder LaPointe, 1854. First settlers to the territory of Minnesota brought with them a view of the land that would profoundly change it. It was a powerful vision whose details had been spelled out nearly a half century before in the Land Ordinance of 1795. One of the most important transformations in the Midwestern landscape is in its beginnings, also in some ways the subtlest, which is the passage in 1785 of the Great Land Ordinance, which for the first time set up United States government, before we had a constitution, and arguably as important as the U.S. Constitution, a process for surveying the land.
The Congress needed to pay off its debts from the Revolutionary War and won all this land. And it needed both to be able to raise money to pay off those debts, but also to be able to have some orderly way of settling that.
The legacy. Still apparent in the grid pattern that dominates the Midwestern landscape.
We can hardly think of a landscape without a grid if we can pause to think about it, because it is, it's like the air we breathe, it's the context in which we all lay out our lives.
One of the key proponents of that grid and the land survey that created it was Thomas Jefferson.
I guess we all know Jefferson's notion was there that democracy needs to have a base of farmers and landowners, and if that was going to be true, they had to be able to get access to ownership to federal land and be able to know what they owned. And that's the reason for the survey.
So we decided on this idea of dividing land into six landscape townships, and that they were actually going to go out and survey each one of those townships prior to settlement, prior to the sales of those lands.
Using the simple tools of a compass and measuring chain, crews began measuring and surveying the entire United States west of the Appalachians.
And working its way west across the Northwest Territory. And then as Louisiana Purchase begins to get surveyed. Mm.
It took more than half a century to survey Minnesota. Crews began in the 1840s and continued through the remainder of the 19th century. In the process, surveying crews measured more.
I have been stung by mosquitoes in this township while standing in snow deep. And marking the trees and other prominent features at specific points along the transects, surveyors noted significant geographical features. The trees, the presence of minerals, soils. In doing so, they were instructed to pay particular attention to the commercial potential of the lands they surveyed. The surface of this township is gently rolling. The timber is very dense, tall, and straight. In sections 2 and 3, there is much white pine, good for lumber. The swamp in section 6 is suitable for cultivation. The water is clear and abounds in speckled trout. Surveyor record.
More than anything else, what the grid achieved, what this vast land survey was designed to accomplish, was making it possible to buy and sell land. The whole purpose was to take nature, ecology, and transform it into real estate, make it possible to buy and sell it, and strikingly, buy and sell it without even knowing where it looked like. You could sit in Washington, D.C., or in Philadelphia, look at a map, look at a cell of the grid, and say, whatever, having walked the land.
But the ordinance had other profound, unforeseen consequences. By dividing the landscape without regard to nature, the grid served to play havoc with the ecological systems that underlay it.
Ecologically, it had some problems. Because all of a sudden, you get people who are purchasing land side by side, and the line that divides them, this arbitrary line, may go right through the middle of a swamp, or may go through a woodlands, or may go through some other ecological area that, for purposes of maintaining the environment, we would be much better off keeping that piece together.
From a strictly biological perspective, the impact is so immense we can't really even fully comprehend it right now. It's happening at all the different levels of biological organization, if you will. It's happening at the genetic level, dividing up populations. It's happening at the species level, some responding differently to these new divisions in the landscape. It's happening at the community level, at the ecosystem level.
Although they couldn't know it then, the survey would be the template for the total reordering of the biological landscape on a scale not seen since the disappearance of the last ice sheet. But the full ramifications of the survey would not be understood for years. What was clear in was that now there was land to be legally had and money to be made in the territory of Minnesota.
We're here at the Falls of St. Anthony, and this is the place that gave Minneapolis its name. Minneapolis means waterfall city. Came from the combination of the Dakota, Minnehaha, and Polis for city. And it's the reason we have a city at this point on the Mississippi River.
Dwarfed now by the very city they made and covered in concrete, it's difficult today to even see the falls, let alone grasp their historic significance. But they were a crucial nexus. Nature and human capital came together in the late 1830s to transform Minnesota and the region. In its natural state,
Situated in the ecological seam between prairie and forest, it lay within easy reach of the Great Prairie to the north. Located just 7 miles above the head of navigation of the continent's greatest river system, the Mississippi, the falls also lay in close proximity to both the Minnesota and St. Croix rivers.
In a way, it was like you and I were building a perfect landscape, and we knew we were going to have regional complementarity. That is, the wood that was growing in the north was going to be needed by the farmers in the south, and there's this nice point in the middle where we can saw all that wood up and make it into planks and, you know, send it down. So, you know, you hate to read too much into these landscapes in the sense of cosmic plans, but it looks like some cosmic plan was at work.
The strategic location of the falls at just the right spot on the landscape was a fact that was immediately grasped by the pioneer entrepreneurs.
Water power is an old technology used for many, many years in the East, and they understood when they got to this water power site on the Mississippi River that this water power was going to build a city.
The wide drop at St. Anthony Falls was ideally suited for the water wheels that captured the current that drove the saw.
I think it's important to remember that everybody who came to Minnesota expected to get rich. That's why they came here. They weren't fleeing the persecution from Wisconsin. So you have to think about a place as an economic landscape or a commodified landscape. People were intending to do things with it.
In the 1837 treaty signed by the Dakota and the Ojibwe, the falls and all the surrounding lands between the St. Croix and Mississippi rivers were ceded to the United States. Within hours of the news of its ratification, the rush was on. Franklin Steele, the settler at Fort Snelling, was the first to lay claim to the east side of the falls. Later came others. Backed by Eastern capital, they understood that control of the falls meant control of all the resources that would be processed there.
They intended to build this big system, and they intended to have it make money for everybody and build a civilization. But they really didn't intend to wipe out the natural landscape and completely clear cut the forest the way they really did. They sort of opened a Pandora's box, and in the end, they couldn't control it. It had a life of its own, and it had an impact beyond what they intended.
In 1847, an experienced logger from the state of Maine named Daniel Stanchfield set off to the north of St. Anthony on a scouting expedition. He was working for Franklin Steele, owner of the east side of the falls. Steele needed capital to build a sawmill and knew his investors would want a report of the timber prospects in Minnesota Territory. On the Rum River near Mille Lacs, Stanchfield encountered the southern reaches of Minnesota's white pine forest and could hardly contain himself.
I made it a practice to climb a tall tree every 6 miles and to lope on his top across the
woods, which reached
far away in every direction. Pine was inexhaustible. 70 sawmills in 70 years couldn't exhaust the white pine I have seen on the Rum River.
What Stanchfield couldn't see and had no way of knowing was what land store for that white pine forest. What nature had taken thousands of years to grow, man would log in fewer than 50. By the middle of the 19th century, Yankee lumberers had largely used up forests in New England and Pennsylvania. They had moved quickly into the Great Lakes pineries of Michigan and Wisconsin and still couldn't keep up with demand. operations began moving northward, first up the St. Croix, and soon after up the Mississippi River valleys, cherry-picking the rich white pine resources that lay close to the rivers. In the timber industry, white pine was king.
This particular individual that I'm standing next to is at least 36 to 38 inches in diameter, probably in excess of 250 years old. It was resistant to rot and decay. It was easy to work with. It was easy to nail. It didn't split and splinter. And also, it was easy to drive on log drives. It floated high. It was called cork pine by many of the river pigs, log drivers. Living as long as 300 years, it was the largest and longest lived of the eastern conifers and the most majestic. Said they were like great harps by which the wind makes music.
But
white pines were only one part of a complex ecosystem.
Spring pines.
You have to sit back.
Species from the great eastern deciduous forest to the south and the vast conifer forests of the north. This mixed forest was a patchwork of forest types. Huge stands of hardwoods and conifers, or mixed stands of both, interspersed with swamps and bogs, and patches of jack. For pines, ground fires were crucial. Fire cleared the forest of dead trees and understory species, which competed with the growing trees for nutrients and light.
The ecology of these big pine trees is that they are dependent upon fires for their regeneration and propagation. We know from looking at historical records that you could expect a stand like this to burn catastrophically about every 250 years. But frequently, there were ground fires. These occur about on a rotation of about every 30 years. They would revisit this site, and for this reason, we're seeing all kinds of trees of different sizes and diameters here. It's dealing with the old growth forest. It's a fairly complex structure.
This landscape of granite rim lakes, swamps and bogs, was ideal for the water and nutrient conserving needle trees. But the place was much more than just trees. Fish, birds, and other wildlife were here too, bound together forest was also home to the Ojibwe, who valued each and every part of this landscape. The animals were hunted for food, and for their fur, skin, and bones, which were used in countless ways. Maple trees were crucial for sugar. Birch was gathered for canoes, wigwams, and cooking containers. Basswood trees were used for carving wooden tools. And the Ojibwe knew and used a host of understory plants for medicinal purposes. Here was northern Minnesota with all its land and trees. We didn't bother other than what we needed of it. And then you had business people, and I think the entrepreneurs and corporate giants who came in and saw all these resources, and they thought, my God, look at this opportunity, you know. And they look at a tree and see BTUs and board feet of profit, you know, and they needed to get at it. And the tree they wanted most was the white pine. Ironically, for all its majesty and importance to lumbermen, the white pine itself was only a minor part of the forest, comprising no more than 7% of all the trees.
White pine's ecology is very interesting because it's a generalist in a sense. Forest tree species. It tended to grow within richer soils as a super canopy tree within the mixture of hardwood forest. So you would have emerging white pines kind of out and above the surrounding shorter and statured hardwoods. You also would have veins of white pine in the forest. White pine often came in areas where disturbance had opened up the mineral soils.
Fire in the men's bubble. Followed the seasons and the movement of water.
Logging took place in the winter months, while the woods were free of underbrush and mosquitoes. In the spring, when the ice broke, the logs would be floated down to the sawmills. The milling process utilized something called a frame saw, and it was a laboriously slow cut mechanism. You turn on a sawmill, start the log, moving through the saw, and go out squirrel hunting. By the time you came back, that log would be sawn, and you could start the process all over again. In conjunction with this initial cut of the upper forests of the Mississippi and St. Croix valleys, the country was changing, growing bigger, and growing westward. By the mid-1800s, the seemingly limitless pine forest west of Lake Superior was attracting a growing number of wealthy entrepreneurs.
These were not your settlers coming to the west in a Conestoga wagon and seeing if they could stake on a claim. These were
well connected to people like the Washburn family, the Morrisons, the Pillsbury's were here early on. They had political connections. Franklin Steele was the son of James Buchanan's campaign manager.
Horses replaced the oxen in the wood, and men became specialized. Camps became larger by the 1880s. Technology had moved in from Michigan. Single saw was replaced by a circular saw. With steam, the process became faster still. Steam from the sawmill engines was pumped back into the mill pond, keeping it open for
logs throughout the winter.
Now sawing could be done year round. The effect on the landscape was dramatic. Small forest clearings suddenly ballooned to huge tracts of stumps
and slash.
By the 1870s, there were 9 sawmills on the St. Croix River at Stillwater. And 15 more at St. Anthony Falls.
So much
sawdust on the Mississippi River that it posed a navigational problem for steamboats.
The mills themselves were built on dams across the river. The logs were run through the mills and then down the sluice way around the falls. If you look at the old pictures, you see a sort of almost a shanty town. Banks on both sides of the river are barnacles of these sawmills grinding away the lumber.
Nowhere was the quickening cut more profoundly felt than at the Falls of St. Anthony. In 1856, owners of the east and west banks of the falls had succeeded in actually diverting the flow of water
out of the main
channel and into a system of canals. This enabled them to sell the falling water to sawmills and other manufacturers needing power.
As they tried to develop the water power of the falls with all of these tunnel systems, they finally reached the breaking point, quite literally.
In dividing the waters, the millers had neglected to consider nature. Beneath the fall, a cap of hard limestone rested atop a bed of softer sandstone. This limestone ledge had been eroding upstream for 12,000 years. As the cascading water scoured out the soft sandstone underlayer, chunks of limestone ledge would
break off
under their own weight
and crash into the river.
And if they kept going for only a few more years, probably about 50 years or so, it would have run out of the limestone shelf that supported it.
This
would have ended the falls
as a source of power. By diverting the waters, the Millers had further weakened the falls until on October 5th, 1869, disaster came. A tunnel collapsed and the falls started to go.
The limestone just broke apart and the river started to reroute. Exit and they created this giant whirlpool in the river. And at first, they thought they could conquer this like they'd conquered everything else. They put together these great rafts of white pine logs and floated it out there. The whirlpool just sucked them down and made an even bigger tunnel.
In 1870, the Army Corps of Engineers was called in to build a wooden apron over the falls. With its still, timber kept coming down the Mississippi. By the late 1870s, the apparently limitless white pine of the Rome River, the St. Croix in the Mississippi, had been cut. Less than 25 years after his breathless assessment of the Rome River pinery, Daniel Stanchfield wouldn't have been able to find the tall tree to climb. Meanwhile, the lumber camps kept growing, moving northward. Of the last ice age to just after the Civil War, human-made changes on the land of Minnesota, though significant, were largely localized and gradual.
When they looked off across the prairie, they couldn't imagine it all being used up as farmland for many, many, many years, because the pace of development up to that time had been relatively steady and straightforward.
Years of the 19th century would bring an explosion of technologies to Minnesota. Steam power had already arrived. Railroads would stretch across the prairie and run deep into the north woods. Steel plows, repeating rifles, and new flour milling technology all were coming. And those tools in the hands of tens of thousands of incoming settlers would bring change at a pace that would astonish even the men and women who were living it.
Pretty interesting, Bill.
Thank you, members, for your attention. Are there any comments before we go to Professor Lanyon, Senator Dill?
Well, just one extra thought that I had. I think when we bought Minnesota, the Louisiana purchase from France, I think we paid something like 2 one-hundredths of a penny per acre. And that was in 1803, 1804, 1802. And then when we bought it again, the federal government bought it again from the Dakota Indians. They sold 28 million acres of land during the 1851 treaty, and I think the federal government paid 7.5 cents an acre for those 28 million acres. And I think that's about what we paid the Ojibwe in the 1837 treaty, something like that. But what was interesting is all of the Indians, the Dakotas, only got 7.5 cents an acre for their land in 1851. By the end of that decade, much of that land was selling for $4 or $5 an acre, and they weren't even getting paid their 7.5 cents on the contract for deed because of the Civil War and so forth. We wound up with the 1862 Indian outbreak because of the failure to make that very nominal payment to them.
Thank you. So the next presentation will be Professor Scott Lanyon, who's director of the Bell Museum of Natural History at the University of Minnesota, which played a large part in the production of this film. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. This was all sort of a last-minute kind of a thing, so I'm happy to answer questions you might have about the program. One thing I would point out is simply that the initiative to do a program like this, which really started with the LCMR, providing some of the seed funding to get it going, and the College of Natural Resources and multiple colleges at the university, really hoping to provide the citizens of Minnesota with a perspective, perspective over the last century or two. And partly, I think the episode you chose to watch today is great in that it really sort of helps show just how much change has taken place in a relatively short period of time. And 150 years ago, there were people sitting around tables just like this making decisions that resulted in the changes we've seen on the landscape, just as you will be making decisions and this legislature makes decisions every day. So I think that's part of the goal, is to provide a perspective, and a perspective on just how much of Minnesota, our economy, our culture, is dictated by the landscape on which we live. So I'd be happy to answer questions you might have about the program or where it's going, because we are doing additional episodes as well. But if there are questions.
Who are the other sources of funding for the...
A lot of private donations to this. Quite a few donors to the Bell Museum specifically, but to societies and individuals who really care about this landscape and really trying to help capture the story. The interesting thing about Minnesota is that we still have people that we can talk to today about things that really have changed our landscape over the last 100 years, but those voices are being silenced now, and it was seen as very, very important to get there and to capture those sort of oral histories, capture those perspectives before we lose them. So a lot of private donations. None of that would have happened without the initial seed money from the LCMR that really made this project possible.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lanyon, at what point in your record keeping, or whatever, are you now?
So this was
still more to do.
This was really sort of a temporal slice through the. This one I believe started at 16,000 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. To the present, the two episodes that are being worked on now are actually more geographic. So one is more of the forest landscape, really focusing in on the forested landscape. And the second one that is just really getting underway is prairie pothole region sort of focus. So it's a little bit less of the time scale. We've already sort of captured the history of the state to the extent that we had hoped to. Now it's really trying to focus in on particular areas where there are unique stories to be told.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Is this, I'm trying to dredging in my memory here, is this the same project that was that kind of a celebration of the first production of the start of it out at the old Freshwater
yes.
Institute? So this is, and it's building on it. There's going to be a continuous. They showed some of it on public television.
That's right. That's right. So the episode.
And there was original music that was created for it, and.
That's right.
This is the same project.
Same project. That announcement, that celebration that happened at the Freshwater Institute was the sneak preview. I'm trying to remember when that was now, but yes, the four episodes then were created, have done very well on public television and have been shown many times throughout the state. And there are other states I know, I couldn't give you the details right now, but I know other states have expressed interest in this project and what was done here, because it really provides a snapshot of history that often is not available. We use this extensively with K-12 education. There's a curriculum that goes with it to help teachers use this to help educate today's youth on the history of the state. And then, yes, we're carrying that on. This production team, if you will, is now part of the Bell Museum itself, and we're doing these next two episodes, but then we also hope to continue this with smaller projects.
Freshwater Institute is in your district, Senator Olson?
Mm-hmm. And I think some of, Mr. Chairman, some of the early donors that put some of that seed money in were recognized at that time. My memory escapes me as to the particular names, but I think it was an exceptional project.
It was. It really brought together some great people. I think one of the things, and you must recognize one of the challenges in doing a project like this, is that There are important lessons to be learned. There's a tendency or a danger of finger pointing to say who did something wrong here and so on. And this project was really done in a way to try to make it clear there's no right or wrong here. This is our history, and it's a history from which we can learn a great deal about the decisions we make, and how minor decisions, what appear to be minor decisions, may actually have profound implications for the environment in which we live and the resources on which we depend.
Paula?
Yes. I know as you were going through the part about all the white pine forests, I grew up with my grandparents in northern Minnesota, north of Little Falls, that they had a lot of white pine on there. And the whistling of the winds through those white pine, it was just a beautiful sound and a beautiful sight. But you see it, you see the clear cutting, and there's a sense of remorse, and yet at the same time you realize what it did for the economy. And yet the same area of the landscape in northern Minnesota is still very beautiful, fully wooded. Is there anything that is, do you see some chapters of how, you hit at the fires are needed for bringing on the next generation? Are there new stands of white pine? Of analyzing where we've come since then? You know, logging is still important. Is it different? But are different species or varieties that have become the basis for the logging industry today? But it continues to rejuvenate and continues to supply and play an important role in our economy.
It does, absolutely, and I think one of the good lessons to be learned is that quite a bit of our environment can regenerate quite well with very little help. Sometimes it needs a kickstart in some areas, mm-hmm. And can do very well. One of the constraints, though, one of the things that's important to recognize is that there are some aspects that take a long time to mature. We have a tendency to make decisions based on relatively short time frames and on profit margins and so on in the short term, thinking about how long it would actually take to bring back a mature white pine stand. That's a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so there are, we have natural areas. There are natural areas that can be regenerated in a relatively short period of time. Whether they'll be mature, whether Minnesota will have the full complement of mature sorts of environments as we once had, that's a different question. Also recognize that one of the things that barely gets into in this series, but is something that certainly the university is looking at very carefully, is what is the future of Minnesota environments with climate change? So that right now there's a tendency for us naturally to think about restoring or comparing our current landscape with the way the landscape was 100 or 200 years ago. But our climate is quite different now, and so even left to its own devices, if you will, the habitat that would regenerate in today's climate is different, and we will have different mixes of plants and animals in some of our regions.
Senator Scoggin, you had your hand up.
Senator Parasol asked my question.
Senator Saxon.
I was just going to make a comment that indeed that 7% of white pine was cut down by logging, but the problem that brought on the white-tailed deer, and the white-tailed deer is what really kept the white pine from regenerating. So that's kind of the...
White-tailed deer love young white pines.
We need more hunting then.
Senator Frederickson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a couple comments occurred as long as we're sitting here just kind of discussing the issues. As Senator Saxog knows, that one of the ways they regenerate white pine now is to go around and put caps on all the buds so the deer won't go out and eat the buds, very time sensitive. And the future effect of global warming on our Minnesota environment, when you see our recommendations from our LCCMR, as Mr. Chairman knows, you will see one of the projects we are proposing funding is to try and predict the effects of global warming on our Minnesota environment and how it's going to change. There was some discussion in the video about the way the lands were surveyed and also about the white pine, and I was thinking of an area called the Lost 40. I think it's in Senator Saxog's district, where there's 40 acres that has never been logged, and it was probably not logged because in the original survey, I believe, and if I'm wrong, correct me, Senator Saxog, it appeared to have been in a lake, so it was not sold for logging, so nobody owned it to log it. And then on top of that, it was just close enough to a rail line so that they think people were afraid to really go in there and steal the timber. So it sits there now as it was before settlement time. And there's some white pine in there. It would take three or four of us holding hands together to get around those white pines. Maybe Senator Saxog wants
to. Well, I remember the Lost 40 from when I was growing up, and that's getting to be a few years, even though a white pine forest and a red pine forest is a long time ago. But I was in there. I just thought I should go up there. I think it's been 4 or 5 years ago to just look at that thing. And a lot of the large trees have blown down and fallen down. You know, it's not as it once was.
Yeah.
No question.
Doesn't last forever.
Mr. Chairman, then that's what happens with growing corn, trees, whatever. You know, it grows, it matures, and it.
They aren't museums.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman. Senator Saxon, where is that Lost 40?
It's in Elwood. It's in the northwest corner of Itasca County, probably about 75 miles northwest of Grand Rapids.
Okay.
Is there good lodging around there so that
many good resorts, Mr. Chair? Yeah.
Other comments?
We're up there. Mm-hmm.
Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, what is your intent? Are we going to watch the rest of the series, or can we check it out from the library and watch it on our own
time? We're going to watch the rest of the series.
Oh, good. Okay. Great. And Mr. Chair, when were these films made?
The project started in 1998. Mm-hmm. They are actually completed about a year and a half ago, I think.
And you said there are two more on their way?
That's correct.
So for a total of six?
For now. As we move forward, the intent originally was just to do the four. In answer to an earlier question, Senator, we had an intent to do that complete timeline. But as the project was completed, then there was great interest from the forestry community, the wood products community, and so on, to actually tell the specific forest story and now the prairie story. So I expect this will continue.
Are you going to get some footage of the Lost 40? Dying to see it. Or maybe that's a field trip, Mr. Chair.
But, Mr. Chair, one of the volumes that is completed is the one on the forest, is it not?
That's correct.
It's just been completed, so.
That's correct. I would be surprised if footage of the Lost 40 isn't in there, but I don't know for sure. I'll have to go and check with the executive producer.
Further discussion? Comments from the public? Okay, if they're not... we will see the committee on Wednesday with Senator Scoggin.
Chairman, just that some senators came in later, and for us new people, if they could do a real quick introduction so we can all be brought up to speed on who's here now.
Thank you for that, Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skolgan, I'm not Senator Olson. I'm Senator Frederickson. That's Senator Olson over there.
Sent to the wrong place in the dark. Came in the dark.
That's so not fair to do that to the new people.
I'm Denny Frederickson, Senator from New Ulm, and I've been a longtime member of this committee.
Senator Pearsall?
Pat Pearsall, my district is mostly some of Dakota County and a little bit of Goodhue County, and Denny is really senior on this committee.
I'm Jen Olson from Senate District 33 in western Hennepin County. Most of my area is water. I represent the Lake Minnetonka area.
Senator Stump.
Leroy Stump, Senate District 1, which is up in the northwest corner of the state.
649 miles from here. Or something like that.
300, half of that.
It is the northwest corner of the state.
And he, tell the rest of the story.
Why I'm in favor of global warming?
Yes. That's the wine business, right?
That's where the buffalo used to be. He just said pretty soon it's growing grapevines in northern Minnesota.
He's not opposed to that.
He has a vineyard.
I had some of his product over the weekend.
Best muster?
It did.
Good.
Okay. Last word, Senator Frederickson, did you have your hand up?
Nope.
So we'll see part two on Wednesday. Thank you all.
Well, Jim, I'll come and see you sometime.
It is true.
There we go. A few ideas.
Well, there you go. Going up there.